I'm David Marcus, host of Drinks with the Deal, and today our guest is Nicole McCarchuk, a private equity partner at Deckard in San Francisco. Nicole, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, David, for having me, and I'm excited to be here.
So we're going to talk about several things on today's podcast, a little bit about you, how you ended up going to law school, and then your career path, both at law firms and then as an in-house counsel at OCSIF and KKR, and how those experiences paralleled changes in the hedge fund and private equity landscape. Your move a few years ago to a smaller boutique credit shop, and then last year, your move to Deckard as a private equity partner. So with that, tell us a little bit about yourself, how you ended up in law school and launched on the practice of law.
So David, I was born in New York on Long Island, and my mother was an immigrant from the United Kingdom, and she came over in the 60s as a registered nurse, met my father, and had decided to stay here because she believed that the United States had a better opportunity for her and her growth, as well as the growth of her family. So as a result, I was the first generation to go to college. I started my collegiate career with working with a guidance counselor who had identified a number of schools for me to go to that I could get money, and whether it's scholarship, financial aid, or otherwise. And that led me to Fordham University undergrad, because at the time they had a 3-3 law program. And I knew then that I wanted to be a lawyer, not the lawyer that I ultimately became, which was private equity, corporate. But actually back then, it was what you see on TV, right? The DAs, the judges, the Supreme Court, and frankly, the public service. So when I was at Fordham, I did everything to absorb that. Interned at the Bronx DA's office, clerked at a judge, and really got as broad exposure as possible to the law. I didn't do the 3-3 law program. I had too much fun as an undergrad, but ultimately was making my way to Georgetown Law when one of my mentors at Fordham, Father McMahon, brought me into the Dean of Financial Aid at Fordham Law and said, she's going to Georgetown unless you make it worth her while. So for the same reason that I chose Fordham undergrad, I chose Fordham Law because they did put a tremendous financial aid package together for me. And I put myself through college and law school and ultimately had about $68,000 of student loan and would have been significantly higher had I not gone to both Fordham undergrad and Fordham Law and Father McMahon, trying to help me along the way.
And then how did you transition from an interest in a litigation-focused public interest career to corporate?
And that really was during Fordham Law. Frankly, everything in law school back then was oriented to litigation, right? The only kind of corporate classes was corporations and real property. And the reality of all of my experience for that first couple of years was all geared in that direction until the whole component of law school is your first year. After your first year, when you really know nothing, you get the summer associate opportunities and you decide, what you're going to do. And so when I was recruited for summer associate, I knew nothing about any of the Wall Street firms, but the reality is financial. Public interest, DA's office, the salaries back then were, $35,000. The corporate salaries were $86,000. So I did the summer associate rotation at White & Case, also recruited to White & Case because of a Fordham alumni. That's what made the connection. That's frankly the only reason I went to White & Case relative to any of the other law firms. What turned me into corporate, however, is, and I tell every law student this, I forced myself to do a rotation. So I did a rotation in litigation. I actually did a rotation in tax and I did a rotation in corporate. And my personality is one that I'm a solutions oriented. I was always taking the analytical approach of trying to find a solution. And even in law school, when you have the Socratic method, right, you're constantly challenged, okay, what's the next step? What's the next step? And you want to find a solution. And when I saw that the early days of litigation, you're mostly in research, you're mostly in the library, you're doing the proofing, you don't get exposure to in the same way that corporate work does, where you're trying to find a solution, even tax, you're coming up with different structures. So after that rotation in that summer, I found I was just enthralled by the corporate experience and chose to join White & Case in the corporate department.
And at that point, private equity was still almost a niche business. There were a handful of firms, many of which are still around today, but they were significantly smaller. The partnerships at those firms were tiny, 10, 15 partners. So how did you end up working in private equity?
Well, so you're completely right. When I joined White & Case, I actually had wanted to do M&A. And White & Case, I was in the finance group. And the first deal I got staffed on was Barry Diller was running Paramount and QVC was bidding on Paramount. It was all in the newspaper. It was exciting. Our corporate department was funding, you know, the finance was funding the acquisition of the bids. And I was at the seat at the table as a first year, frankly, just sitting next to Mr. Diller signing the signature pages on the commitment papers, right? But I knew I wanted to do M&A, and some of the work that I had done at White & Case and the corporate finance side gave you exposure to equities and transactional. And when I went out on maternity leave at White & Case, there was a connection that was made between a client and John Sudam, who at the time was a lead managing, not quite managing partner at a boutique law firm called O'Sullivan, Grave & Carabell. And they were focused on private equity, which back then was really leveraged buyouts, right? There was, we didn't quite have the term, you know, private equity. And there was a connection made there. And I got a phone call to come in and talk to them about joining the firm. And the conversation was just amazing. It was life-changing for me because I had been out on maternity leave. And back then, there is no maternity leave, right? It was 4 weeks or 6 weeks of disability. But I had been a 4 years associate, having not taken any vacation time. So I actually had like 2 months of vacation time that I used during this time period. And so I met with John. And in the first 5 minutes, he's asking me about my child, my life. 40 minutes later, he's extended me an offer and I've accepted, not fully knowing exactly what I've accepted. And that was the opportunity where I really learned to become a private equity lawyer, joining a private equity boutique law firm where that's all we did. It was a firm of like 35, 40 people, all corporate. We were responsible for running the totality of the deal. And as a private equity lawyer, I say this a lot, we're not always experts in everything, but we are experts in managing the deal, managing the components of the deal, understanding the client's perspective, effectively being the conciliary to the client, the innovation, the solutions oriented, and pulling all the pieces together. And that's where I learned and really became what I say is the business person's lawyer through that experience at O'Sullivan, Grave & Carabell.
And then how did you transition to OctZiff, which is obviously an in-house position? And why did you decide to go in-house when you did?
So my career trajectory, in many respects, follows the evolution of what may be now asset management, right? Whether that's private equity, hedge funds. O'Sullivan, Grave & Carabell had merged with O'Melveny & Myers. There was an expansion that was going on in connection with that merger. I was writing my partner memo and making the business case for promotion to partner. And I got a phone call. And I got a phone call from a headhunter at a time where we were navigating for points and, you know, the typical law firm dynamic. And I met with the recruiter. I didn't know anything about OctZiff or what a hedge fund was. He found me because they had some press and some deals that had been out there. And OctZiff at the time was a multi-strategy hedge fund that was looking to converge and do private equity. Back then, there was that convergence. Hedge funds were moving into private equity. They were doing some side pocket illiquid investments in the hedge fund structure. They had just hired two partners, one from Blackstone, one from CVC, and they were looking for a general counsel to help them build that business.
And this is, I think, about 2004, just as private equity, just as the boom in private equity is beginning.
That's exactly right. And again, John Sudam, managing partner running All Melvany at this point, but also a very good mentor. And we talked about it, you know, the opportunity set of being able to be in-house and help drive while also, you know, keeping a good balance with my children and the other aspects that was going on in my personal life as well. So Axif recruited me. I actually turned them down the first go around because I was going to stay in the law firm. At that point in time, I had some flexibility. I was working one day a week from home and I didn't want to lose that flexibility. And I turned Axif down. And then Axif came back and said, we understand. You know, there was a PE partner there that had a wife that was a working mother. And he said, what if we gave you the same opportunity to work one day a week from home? Which frankly was really unheard of at that point in time. And it didn't adjust compensation. It didn't adjust prospects. And again, similar to when I accepted the O'Sullivan, Grave and Caribel job on the spot, I just knew that was the right call for me. And I accepted and then we joined. And Axif at the time was really just, you know, taking off in terms of raising that side pocket illiquid activity and just driving the transactions globally was exciting.
And so what was your role at Axif where you spent about 6 years?
So at Axif, I was the global general counsel for transactions. And really what that meant is we started with building the team and therefore the transactions that flowed from that. So anything related to a, you know, it started more illiquid private equity like transactions, but, you know, non-control effectively, right? So that was how they were positioning themselves. That was differentiated, that we had pools of capital, but it would be non-control, but in a format where the role of GC or my role in GC was actually an extension of the deal team, right? We were really hand in hand driving the structuring, the negotiation of terms. You know, there were a handful of people that had the private equity like training and the rest were just smart hedge fund industry executives that knew the business. And so we really partnered with the private equity execution skill set and with the industry expertise of the analysts and the executives at Axif. And we kind of grew it globally. So we expanded in the UK, expanded in Asia, expanded into emerging markets, as well as energy. Energy became public and private transactions and real estate. And really, it just exploded in growth and opportunity. And we were extremely busy during that time period.
And as this is happening in the large private equity transactions in 2004 to 2007, oftentimes the equity was syndicated, that you would, this was the era of the club deal. You'd have a handful of private equity firms acquire a company, put some leverage on it, but then sell some of that equity to other investors. So there was emerging a more complicated capital structure than would have been the case in the PE deals of the 80s and 90s.
Absolutely right. And actually very astute when I think about not only the evolution of the industry, but also the evolution of my career. Because in many respects, when sitting in the seat at Axif, we'd be getting the call from a KKR equity syndication desk on whether or not we wanted to come in and fill the hole. And, you know, back then it was like the deals were getting bigger and bigger. There were more checks that were being written. And so, in, you know, we often was on the first call that was coming in, you know, to legal and compliance because you, do you want to get restricted? Are you over the wall? How do you want to think about it? Because you've got a public traded book as well at Axif. So I was often on the phone with the equities desk in the US helping to create a process to evaluate those opportunities.
And then how did you end up moving to KKR in 2010?
So again, another convergence. So when I think about my career trajectory, it was hedge funds going into private equity when I moved in-house. There was also private equity and the original, you know, private equity sponsored firms also going into multi-strat. So you saw the convergence of hedge funds going into private equity like investing. And then KKR, when I joined KKR, it was just an opportunity on a couple of fronts. KKR Financial, which was a NYSE listed vehicle, needed a general counsel. So I had the opportunity to become a public company general counsel. I had been involved in some aspects of the IPO at Oxif and selling of the stake in the management company and obviously being part of that process, but I wasn't the chief legal officer of the public asset management firm. So the KKR Financial opportunity was an ability to really expand my skill set in that vein. But more importantly, you know, KKR was moving into the alternatives. So they were diversifying. KFN started with the beginning seed of the asset management business for credit and hedge funds of funds, and really expanding beyond the core private equity business. So the move for me going from Oxif to KKR was both an opportunity to be the general counsel of a public company, which was one of the vehicles that KKR was using to grow the asset management business, and an opportunity for me to move from purely transactional, which is really what I was at Oxif, to what I call now the asset management lawyer. Because what does that mean when you think about supporting multi-strategy private equity managers or asset managers, which is effectively what hedge funds and private equities are, is really, you know, the underlying investment strategies and the transactions. It's the capital raising aspects of it too, fundraising and all different types of innovative products. And growth, right? So at KKR, it was just a great opportunity to really be at the ground in a similar way that I was at Oxif to the expansion of the asset management business there.
And this is a trend that's continued where KKR obviously had its roots going back to the 70s, very much as a leveraged buyout private equity firm. Obviously, like many of its competitors, notably Blackstone, has become a multi-class asset manager. And you've seen the same thing at some hedge funds. How did that affect your role as an in-house counsel? And then how does that affect what legal advice these entities need from their outside counsel?
Well, how it affects the business, and frankly, even, you know, when I put it in terms of my own career, it's just exciting, right? Because it's constantly innovating, it's constantly emerging, staying ahead of. I mean, the reason why they diversified is what are the other opportunities that we see that's growing? And I remember the recruiting pitch that Scott Nuttall gave me at the time to come over to, you know, KKR is that he believed that the credit side of the business or the alternative asset management side of the business, as they diversified their balance sheet, was someday going to be bigger than, from an AUM perspective, than the core private equity. And if you actually see that, that is in fact true, but you still need a visionary and you need a infrastructure that's willing to make mistakes, take risk in order to diversify and have that visionary. And some of the core key leaders in the space, you know, have that. And they're willing to sort of take a chance, try it out. Not everything works. Some of it doesn't. And I think from a legal perspective, again, I go back to the roots of a transactional lawyer. We're not always experts in everything, but you can figure it out. And the core of the advice and being that business person's lawyer is having the ability to innovate and find a path or a solution that allows your client in that case to evolve, to get ahead of, to adjust to the dynamic, while also making sure that you're reinforcing and building an infrastructure that can support that scale, as well as reinforcing the regulatory requirements and making sure that they're doing it in the right way, in the right manner to comply with the overall objectives, which is growth, meeting investor returns, and meeting your compliance and regulatory obligations.
And then in 2018, you moved to Angel Island Capital, which was a boutique credit fund. Talk about the reasons behind that move and also the rise of private credit.
So at KKR, I had really expanded my skill set. So I, as I mentioned, I became an asset management lawyer. I was less in the weeds on the transactional side and more on the weeds in the fundraising side and in the strategic growth. So we had strategic M&A, and I'd be obviously in the weeds in that. And, you know, to the extent we had a transaction that was going south or a distressed transaction, I'd be in the weeds. But one of the things that I really loved was sort of like taking that skill set across all of that and really, you know, contributing to that growth. And one of the largest areas of growth there was private credit. That's how I actually started working with Deckard and the launch of BDCs and different innovative products along those lines. But what I also personally like to do is mentor. And so when I was at KKR, I built out a secondee program of different law firms giving us secondees and growing and mentoring. And a group of colleagues of mine at KKR had left KKR and went to Angel Island Capital. It's a boutique portfolio. At the time, it was a boutique portfolio company of Golden Gate Capital, a middle market private equity shop. And they were growing the business. And Golden Gate had a vision of replicating, you know, a asset management platform, multi-diverse, starting with Angel Island as the credit boutique, and then eventually expand. And, you know, they just kept tapping me for different ideas. You know, how do we think about it? You know, these are my friends and my colleagues. And about 18 months into it, they were having a lot of fun. They said, would you be interested in coming over? You know, a pure credit boutique wasn't entirely what I was thinking of. But I had the opportunity to join Angel Island as the COO. And as the COO, I was responsible for branding, mission, vision, as well as talent management. And tying into my mentorship and really trying to give back in that regard, it was what really drove me to the Angel Island opportunity and the potential for that to grow into a much broader strategic M&A platform for Golden Gate at the financial services level.
And talk a little bit about your experience there.
It was great. I joined pretty much 2019. We launched an opportunistic credit fund, the first third-party fund that Angel Island had done. It was innovative in that Golden Gate had seeded a large portion of the balance sheet of assets. And as part of that, we were able to raise secondary investors in a different way in a primary fund. So again, more innovation. And we raised our first successful fund. Other investment strategies that we were launching was asset-based and really having a vision of growth. And COVID hit. And COVID hit at a time where, if you see what the industry was, the market went a little haywire and new business harder to do. Fundraising went to those large platforms where investors already had the opportunity to do on-site due diligence, had the opportunity to do a number of things, and financing freed up. So we mostly focused in 2020. On the underlying portfolio and shoring up what we can do. And that's where my hat led into the talent management. It really was exciting to be building and mentoring, but then also now COVID, that's a tough time period. You had a whole host of individual young talent isolated and working through all the issues. And that's where I felt my experience of years of management, risk management, and crisis management really came into play in managing all the diverse interests to make sure that we stayed the course and managed the portfolio.
And then last year, you moved to Deckard. Talk about your decision to transition back to a law firm after almost 20 years of being in in-house positions.
Yeah, so I didn't say it earlier, but when I left from KKR and OXIF and, you know, White and Case, like, you know, they were all large multinational platforms. And so when I made the leap to OGK, Sullivan, Grave & Caravel, it was a boutique law firm. It was a bit more entrepreneurial. That's how we ran it. When I left and joined my colleagues at Angel Island, it was more entrepreneurial, sort of startup without necessarily the same startup risk. But the COVID impact kind of changed that a little bit, and it became much more singular in credit. So I started thinking in 2021, what I really like to do is grow. What I really like to do is grow a business. What I really like to do is be that conciliary. And I was always, as an in-house GC, a more hands-on GC. I was always one that was in the weeds, whether it was the transaction or the product or the growing. And so when I really took a step back, what really motivated me is being the lawyer, right? Like really the practice of law, the innovation. And so I started taking a look and saying, okay, do I want to go back to private practice? And if so, what does that look like?
And so what were the advantages of going to private practice for you? And what were the things you were concerned about that you had to get comfortable with in making that move?
Well, so it took a solid year of talking to a lot of people in terms of whether or not this was a decision that I should do. And on one hand, when you're in a law firm, you've got to generate business. And how do you generate business? And what are the relationships you have and the ability to generate that business? And when you're in-house, you don't have to worry about that. The business just comes. And so I really needed to take a step back and say, do I have the relationships, the ability to go into that sales mode to generate those revenues? And is there enough of a relationship out there? The other is going back to the real practicing lawyer and really staying abreast and making sure that you've got the current market. You go in-house and you stay relevant, except your market is your organization's market, right? And that is a lot different than sort of a broader sense of the market. And where you get the broader sense of the market is your relationships with the law firms. Where are you seeing these evolve? So coming back into the law firm, I knew I was going to have to take some time to really ramp and make sure I'm comfortable and confident enough that I actually am relevant and know the market. Both of those were the two things that I had focused in terms of going back to private practice. But I found the advice and the people I talked to, that was something that was not an impediment to making that decision.
And then as you've made that transition back to private practice, one, how have you thought about developing the business side of the practice? And then maybe easier for you, because it sounds like you did really like being immersed in the law, which some people in-house don't enjoy as much. How did you make that transition to having that be the core of what you do, which it isn't always if you're an in-house lawyer?
Yeah, so it's interesting, right? Because when I went in-house, I thought, I want to be part of the sausage making. I want to be part of the whole thing. And not, you know, you never really see that. You get the advice and you'll be part of the sausage making. When you go into private practice, you're involved in the innovation and giving the advice and the creation, but you're not involved in the implementation. And I really, you know, took a step back and realized, I'm not getting as much joy out of the implementation that I thought I would.
Right.
And so where I think the, you know, having financial services clients is that innovation and partnering with those clients in creating that innovation and working on the deal and giving the advice, you need to be able to be that conciliary and that businessman's lawyer. But fundamentally, we can now give you the advice. We can negotiate and get the transaction done, but now someone else has to live with the innovation or the implementation, or frankly, the risk of not taking the advice and making another call. Whereas when you're in-house, you kind of have to live with the decision on whether or not they took your advice. And if not, you still have to manage the risk of not doing so.
And so have you found that transition energizing to having a much different perspective on the practice and relationship to the client.
I do, but I also think that having been in-house and having that seat, I know what they're focused on, both from a legal and a business perspective. And I think that I can give the advice as the external counsel in a more effective way in helping them come up with the innovation of a new product or a new investment strategy, but also in the weeds of a deal and highlighting, here are the things you care about, and be willing to give a recommendation as to what to do. Because when you think about your client base, they're young. You've got maybe some senior partners that have the years of experience, but they're not on every single deal. And so what you're working with is you're working with vice presidents, principals. They're growing in their own career. And so the way that you can be the most effective is continuing to be that conciliary and providing that advice, but also be willing to make a recommendation, which really helps them evolve and helps for a better product.
So you would say that your experience in-house gave you just a better understanding of the internal dynamics at an asset manager and how those may impact how you deliver the advice you're going to deliver.
Exactly. Well said. Much better than I've just explained it.
And so as you look out over the next couple of years, how do you foresee developing your practice?
Well, again, as I kind of walk through, my career has really evolved alongside this shift in private equity and asset management. As I started earlier, walking from in-house to hedge funds with the convergence to private equity and going to KKR, which was really that convergence of private equity expanding into private credit, hedge funds, and other alternatives. In addition to sort of thinking through what I wanted to do after AIC, I also thought, see, there's a convergence. There's a convergence of the industry where we've got the traditional investment managers, the mutual funds, the ETFs that kind of do distribution into the retail space. And you've got those traditional managers really converging and acquiring alternatives, right? And going into the more private equity, private credit, and other alternative investing. And likewise, you've got the KKRs, Blackstones, Apollos of the world, who really are multi-strategy asset managers that historically launched to institutional investors, equally wanting to take their alternatives to the masses, right? To the retailization of those investment strategies. And when I thought about that, that's one of the reasons why I chose to join Deckard, because I wanted to be on a platform that really thinks about and has the capability and the skill set to evolve with that change in industry. And I wanted to be part of being able to be innovative both on the deal, whether that's strategic M&A of the traditionals into acquiring the alternatives, which Deckard had been a leader in 2021, particularly in a number of those transactions, as well as be on a platform for the balance of my career with what I was reminiscent of OGK. Partners that are collaborative, have an infrastructure that work together well, and that can take, regardless of your background, whether you're a PE, M&A, or a funds formation, we can come together, create a collaborative team that can meet the client's evolution in financial services. And I had worked with a lot of the law firms, and there's only a handful that truly in practice operate in that way. And that's ultimately that led me to Deckard, because I thought I'd have the right platform to be able to build a business with my partners that have the relevant expertise and capability of being innovative to continue to evolve, whether that's the retailization or new investment strategies like the stakes, secondaries, and seedings that was emerging post-COVID. And all of that is what led me to come to Deckard. And that's the practice that I'm now focused on helping to evolve, are secondaries and stakes business line, as well as investment opportunities in financial services.
And then finally, tell us a little bit about how you decompress from what's clearly a demanding career.
What I tell everyone, and frankly, I tell this to my children every day, you have to find a passion, right? And if you're passionate about what you do, it's demanding. It keeps you excited and you're driving towards that. And you need to bring in your other aspects of your life that also gives you that opportunity to decompress. For me, it's my family. For me, it's my children. And making sure that they're integrated with my professional to the extent that I can be. And one thing that we have always done is made sure we had a vacation of some sort. And we travel, and whether that's in Florida and Disney or in the Maldives on the beach, we've done Africa safari, we've traveled in Asia. But the common theme to all of it is just family time over dinner. And just really making sure that you use that opportunity to engage in the dialogue on how great was that day today, or like, nah, I didn't really have a good day, but really engaging and being present and having that dialogue. In our vacation time, even when I was able to work, I always managed to somehow do it in a way that they didn't feel like it impacted too much. And we always had the dinner time to decompress and have that conversation. And we've really enjoyed that. And I also feel like those are experiences that they remember. You have to be present, but you sometimes do miss events because of a transaction that's come up or a closing or something that's come on. But they do remember the vacation and the times and the experiences that we had in that regard.
Nicole, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. This is really exciting. I appreciate it.
For Drinks with the Deal, I'm David Marcus.